This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, writer Joe R. Lansdale, grew up poor in East Texas, but he's always had a fertile imagination. One example is the plot of his novel Bubba Hotep. Elvis and John F. Kennedy are alive and living in a nursing home where they battle an Egyptian mummy who comes to feast on the elderly. Bubba Hotep is one of two Lansdale novels that were adapted to films. Writer Lisa Morton has said Lansdale is his own distinct genre. He's written horror, mystery, westerns, graphic novels and comics, and mainstream literature. He's published more than 40 novels and 30 short story collections. His series of mysteries about two East Texas characters named Hap and Leonard is the basis of a new TV series on the Sundance Channel. It stars James Purefoy and Michael Kenneth Williams, and it premieres next Wednesday. I spoke to Joe R. Lansdale about his life and career and his new Hap and Leonard novel, Honky Tonk Samurai. Well, Joe Lansdale, welcome to Fresh Air. If you could just describe these two characters, Hap Collins and Leonard Pine, a little bit. Tell us about Hap.
Hap is a former war resister. He didn't go to Vietnam. He protested against it. He is heterosexual and liberal and lives in East Texas. His best friend is Leonard Pine, who is black, gay, and conservative, and was a Vietnam War hero.
All right, and they're good buddies, and they do...
They are the best of buddies. They have a solid core that keeps them together, even though they may have different beliefs about different things, that at the core, they have a sense of honor and a sense of brotherhood, and in many ways, I think that that's what this book is about, is brotherhood. And I think in this day and time, when you can't get people to agree on anything or even agree to disagree, I think it's kind of got a little bit of a nice message there that slips out.
And they've done all kinds of odd jobs together. Some of it is as private investigators, right?
A little bit. In the most recent one, they end up working for a private investigative agency that Hap's girlfriend, Brett, buys from the previous owner. But mostly in the past, they've done the jobs I did, which was working in the rose fields, potato fields, bouncing, aluminum chair factories, et cetera, the blue-collar jobs, which I did when I was, you know, trying to get to the point where I could write full-time.
All right. Let's have you read a little bit from early in the book. This is a moment in which Hap and Leonard are staking out a guy. They've been hired by a client who thinks that her husband may be cheating on her. Turns out he isn't, but they're out in front of this guy's house, and this is what unfolds. If you'd read for us.
Sure. There we sat, me reflecting on these things and holding in a wheat bread fart out of courtesy, when Leonard said, "What the hell?" He was looking at a yard across the street from our car. A man had a dog on a leash, and the dog was cowered on its belly, and the man was kicking it. And I could hear him screaming at it. The dog yelped a couple of times after the kicks. Leonard was already out of the car by this time and crossing the street. I got out and went around and followed. Heard Leonard yell, "Hey, how about you try kicking me?" The man stopped his dog abuse and looked up. I let the fart ease out. I did it quietly, not wanting to frighten the dog. I left the fart where I had laid it like a rotten egg and moved away from the smell. "Who the hell are you?" the man said to Leonard. "I'm the man fixing to put that leash on your neck and kick you all over this yard like a soccer ball." "You're trespassing," the man said. "That's just where I start," Leonard said. "How about I put one of your damn eyes out?" Appeared like a start to a fairly ordinary day for us.
And that is Joe R. Lansdale reading from his new book, Honky Tonk Samurai. Leonard is such an interesting character. Tell us about him. I mean, parts of Hap's biography square pretty well with yours.
They do a whole lot.
Where does Leonard come from?
Leonard comes from a number of people, both white, black, gay, and heterosexual. I mean, it's a mixture of people. You know, I always disliked that anytime you had gays represented in, and there were some exceptions, certainly, but it represented in popular fiction, they were usually the goofy neighbor next door, you know, and... I just thought, well, I know a lot of gay people, and they're just as varied as the heterosexual people I know. And there were a lot of tough gay people that I encountered when I was, you know, as I've done martial arts over the years. And I wanted to represent another side of it. And I thought that this was a way of doing it. And I honestly didn't even know Leonard was going to be in the book until I wrote the first paragraph. And there he was. And then I had no idea he was gay until it was kind of revealed in something Hap said. And all of that just sort of developed. I had no idea I was doing a series. I thought I was writing a standalone. But this character, not only Hap, who tells the story, but Leonard, to me, is equal importance to the stories. And so he just kind of developed out of that. And like I said, the people I knew and all the people I'd worked with, done martial arts with. So that's where he comes from.
You live in East Texas. I mean, people who know Texas well, as I do as a native, know that it's really several distinct regions. And East Texas is much more like the Deep South than any of the rest of it. Which is more like the Southwest. And, of course, you know, there's a long history of racial issues there. And you have been called the conscience of East Texas. I mean, I wonder if in some respect this character, Leonard, is a way for you to explore a lot of issues about, you know, attitudes and social relationships.
Without a doubt. I mean, I didn't set out to think I'm going to be the conscience of anybody other than myself. But what happened is when I begin writing these books, those things that were a part of me begin to slide into them. Those things that I had seen when I was growing up in the South were certainly in the background. And I think social issues and political issues, without beating people over the head, have always been a part of my work in the more so-called serious books I've written, as well as the Hap and Leonard series and what have you. But it wasn't that I sat down and says, I'm going to be the conscience. I just sat down and said, I want to say something about the 60s, late 60s and early 70s. Actually, when people refer to the 60s, they often are actually including the 70s in that. And what I wanted to do was write something about that, and I never could find a vehicle for it. So when I started writing this crime novel, it just naturally found its place.
Describe East Texas and what your childhood was like there.
Well, I was born in the 50s, 1951, so I grew up during that part of the 50s when everything was supposed to be at its best in America, they claimed, and then eased into the 60s. But we were probably a little better off in the 50s, but we were always poor. My dad couldn't read or write, and my mom had an 11th grade education, which I believe actually was as far as some of the schools went when she was going to school. And my dad was a mechanic, and my mother was a homemaker, but she also sold World Book encyclopedias, and she painted and sold paintings. She did all kinds of things. And I remember when when people say, oh, the 50s were just this great time, I thought, well, yeah, if you were rich, white, and male. Because let me tell you, it wasn't all that wonderful if you were black, or if you were female, or even if you were poor. And so those are the things that stuck with me. I mean, I lived a very happy life. I never felt poor. Our family euphemism was that we were broke, which I think psychologically gave you a different feeling. There were people far worse than we were. You know, we often did pretty well comparatively because East Texas was in a general sense, was a poor place for everybody, most everybody. So we didn't feel terribly out of place. But as I got older, I could look back and start seeing these things and think, you know, the racism was terrible. They had water fountains that said colored and, you know, washaterias that said colored. And we had segregated schools, and people thought this was perfectly natural and perfectly okay. I remember going to a theater once, and there was a stairway that wound its way up the back. And I was very young, a small child. And I said to my mom, why are those people going up those stairs? And she said, you know, I don't know how to tell you this. I don't know how to explain it, but it won't always be that way because it's wrong. And I never forgot that. It wasn't like one of those moments where everything just comes together, but it was certainly somewhat euphoric in the back of my mind, like somebody had lit a candle or turned on a light. And then when Martin Luther King came along and started speaking and saying what he had to say in such an extraordinary manner, I was deeply moved. And from that point on, I was very much a proponent of civil rights.
Going back a bit, I mean, your dad was a mechanic. He was a shade tree mechanic, right? Worked out of his yard?
Yeah, yeah. My dad, the way he actually became a mechanic, he used to work in canneries and field work, and he would catch trains and hobo. I mean, not catch them and, like, pay a ticket. He would sneak on board the, you know, box cars or hang underneath them, and he would ride the rails to different towns where they had carnivals and fairs, and they had boxing and wrestling in those fairs, and he would enter these contests and make money. And that's part of what he did to sort of supplement what they were doing during the Great Depression. Because my dad was born in 1909, my mother in 1914, so they were older. when I was born. So he didn't really have a profession. But my mother said, what is it that you would really like to do? And he said, I've always wanted to be a mechanic. So she bought him an old car. I think it was like a Model A or something. And she said, why don't you take that car apart and put it back together until you can do it blindfolded? And that's exactly what he did, and that's how his career started.
What did you do for fun as a kid?
Well, we went fishing. We went hunting. Back then, though, fishing and hunting wasn't just a recreational thing. It was something you did to eat. My father once told me we went out, we're squirrel hunting, and we, you know, I think he saw I was getting kind of excited about it. He says, you know, this isn't a sport. Everybody tells you hunting's a sport. It's not. And he says, if you start to enjoy seeing something fall or die, you need to sit down and have a really serious talk with yourself. So this is to eat, and that's all. And he was a very, very racist in his speech and whatever. You know, I was just, my mother was just the opposite. But what happened was that when we'd go squirrel hunting, if he would kill two or three extra, and he would bring them to a black family that he knew who were more desperate than we were. And the same thing when he went fishing. And he was always doing stuff like that. So I judged him more by what he did than what he said.
There's a fair amount of violence in a lot of these stories, and yep. I want to have you read another piece for us.
Okay.
We've talked about this. This is on page 193, well into your new book, Honky Tonk Samurai.
Right.
Do you want to set up we don't want to give away the whole story, but do you want to kind of set up what's happening here?
Well, I think the easiest thing to say is that they have found out that there are some bikers involved with their problem. I'm just going to call it a problem because I don't want to give it away. And
this is Hap and Leonard, our two characters, Hap, and then a buddy of theirs. What, Jim Bob, is that his name?
Jim Bob Luke. And they have come out there to sort of spy on these guys, who are also meth heads, and they've got to the point where they find out that these people have kidnapped somebody they know and that their plans for that person are not really good. And so this is their response.
Well, I will just note that what they're about to do is go. This is at night, there's a bonfire, lots of mean bikers there, and they're about to go charging at them in
right.
a car, two of you hanging outside with shotguns trained and hoping you can get
right.
in and rescue this person without getting, just being able to get out alive.
And it's a red Cadillac they're driving.
It is a nasty situation to be going into. And then you're writing in the first person here as Hap, describing
right.
what it feels like. Go ahead, if you will.
Situations like that, it's like you and time are frozen in amber, and then the amber breaks and you're not frozen, but everything moves for a time in slow motion. If it's your first time or two doing something like that, going into the midst of danger and uncertainty, you have tunnel vision. You see what's in front of you as if looking down the length of a tunnel. Everything to the right and the left of you is a black wall, but if you've been there before, it's not that way. On some level, like the samurai of old, you have accepted your death. You are neither there to win or to lose. You are there to be in the moment. Things may be slow, but they are viewed wider with experience, not inside that fearful tunnel of the neophyte. That's how it was with me. I could see clearly. I could feel clearly. I might add right here that I say, to hell with the samurai. I planned to win. I planned to go home. And I knew that plan had about as much chance as a slug in a salt box. I knew, too, I had survived worse situations. And as that thought galloped through my head, another less pleasant thought showed up. Sometimes your luck runs out.
And that's our guest Joe Lansdale reading from Honky Tonk Samurai. What struck me when I read that was, this sounds convincingly like a guy who has been in perilously violent situations before. Is that you?
That would be true, yes.
Yeah. How close have you come to something like this?
Well, something like this, no. But things of, let's just say that I've been close to some of its cousins.
Well, describe one of those cousins for us.
Well, I would say that many times when my hair was really, really long, I had a guy that was much bigger than me that decided at work where I was working that he was going to hurt me, and I put him in the hospital. But I've also had a number of those things during the late 60s, early 70s, where just the sight of somebody with long hair led to all kinds of yells and whistles and threats, and some of those went beyond that. And I've had, you know, people pull guns on me and knives and things like that. So I've been close enough that I know how it feels. I also know about tunnel vision, because when you are beginning to be experienced or less experienced or not experienced at all, when something frightening happens, it is. It's like a tunnel vision. You don't see to your left and your right. You lose peripheral vision completely. But after you've been involved in a number of things, it's just the opposite. It's as if everything widens and everything is clear and everything is real. It's an extraordinary feeling that I'd rather not experience again. But, you know, that's one of the things that martial arts does for you, is it makes you confident, but it also makes you less stupid. Because after you've had these kind of things happen to you, you know better how to avoid them. I grew up in East Texas, and at a time when I was growing up, what was really important was being macho, was being the tough guy, was being the guy that would face down, you know, threats. And not all of that's bad, but some of it is, because it's just ego and, you know, it's just machoism. But a lot of that, I think, helped define my character, both negatively and positively. But I hope, too, that the negatives taught me things that led to positives.
What were the positives?
Well, I think the confidence is one of them, and the fact that I don't have to prove things. You know, I don't have to do this. I'm confident enough with myself that I don't have to show you how tough I am unless you're threatening me and I have no choice. And then you better bring you a sack lunch, because you're going to be there all day.
Okay. So you grew up poor in East Texas, in the country, and but your mom got you into books early. When did you start writing?
I started writing as soon as I discovered pencils. I was trying to write comic books. I was trying to draw them. And then I discovered one day that I had one severe problem. I had no artistic talent. I couldn't draw. But I could write, and I liked the stories better than the art. And so it started developing from there. And I think the first full piece I did was a poem when I was nine. I had done these comic book stories. And then that led to a short story. And then I just started writing from there. And by the time I was 11, 12, 13, I was in that area. I was beginning to write very, very seriously with the intent of becoming a writer, because I had finally realized people got paid for this and that you could do this and I didn't have to work in a factory all my life or get a college education and end up stuck doing something that, even though I might like it, might not be what I really wanted to do, which was write books.
Did you get encouragement? Did people, you know, take
No, I didn't get any except my parents. My parents were always encouraging. My father always, he knew how hard it was not to be able to read and write. And he just always encouraged me just to be the best I could at something. But my mother was a tremendous encouragement. And I think she understood early on that I wanted to be a writer. And my older brother also, and my sister-in-law especially, she used to type up all my manuscripts and stuff. So my family, my immediate family, was very supportive. But outside of that, I think a lot of people had no idea I wanted to do it. And I think, some of the teachers I had some good teachers, but I don't remember being encouraged much. I remember reading a story and a play both in the same class, and people cheered when I got through reading it and when we got through performing the play, and I got a B. And it's because I used colloquial language and this and that, you know, and I thought, okay, maybe the reality of writing is just not the same. That was my first editorial problem.
You mean you couldn't be writing like you talked?
Apparently, that's not what they wanted, and I wanted to write stories that were like Twain, you know, or like people that I knew. I don't think I actually knew that at the time, but that's what I was trying to do. And then once I got older, I started trying to write like everybody else, and that wasn't working for me. So I just said the hell with it, and I started doing stories my way. It's not trying to write about places I didn't know, like New York and Los Angeles. I might know something about them now, but at that time, I had never been to those places, didn't know anyone that had ever been there. And 77 Sunset Strip was as close as I'd ever gotten to Los Angeles, and that was a TV show. So I began to write stories about people I knew. There was a writer named Ardith Mehar, a forgotten writer, and shouldn't be. She wrote a short story once called Crawfish, and it was in an Alfred Hitchcock anthology, and it was written in East Texas vernacular. And when I read that, I thought, hey, I can do this. It just gave me a freedom. And she and I became dear friends over the years, but her story and just my experience had already started pushing me that way. And once I moved that way, you know, completely, then my life changed. For 3 years, I couldn't sell anything. And then it changed again because it caught on.
There was a stretch where you did farming, didn't you? You and your first wife?
Yeah, my wife and I, that's what we were doing. When we first got married, we had a goat dairy, and we worked for other farmers, but we had our own organic farm, and we sold vegetables. And we did that for a couple of years. But one year the heat wiped out my sweet potatoes. I said, you know, this could be far more difficult than I expected. I had grown up with farm people, though, so I knew something about it, you know. And my dad's, when he was younger, and my dad's people had been sharecroppers because they, you know, he was born in 1909. So I knew a little bit about how it was done, but I ended up getting another job and then getting another and moving to Nacogdoches again. I mean, because that's where we had met, and went back to Nacogdoches, and I worked there as a janitor in the college, and then I worked at a hospital and then a high school, and then I sold two books back to back, and I went full time.
How did you get better? I mean, it didn't sound like you were workshopping and that kind of thing.
No, I'll tell you how I got better. Is a very important thing is I when I was writing the nonfiction pieces, I was doing a lot of work in the rose fields, and the weather got really, really bad and icy. In fact, we found a body under a bridge one day, my boss and I. So it was a real bad time to be working in the fields because everything was cold, it was wet, we were having these floods. So my wife said, well, why don't you just stay home for 3 months? I have a job. I'm going out. She was working for what was Southland Corporation then, wearing a little freezer suit that would protect her, and she would pack lunch meat. And so she said, take 3 months off and write, but when I come home, you better have something written. And so when she went to work, I didn't know any better, so I wrote one short story every day for 90 days. And they were all awful. But it got all the junk out of my system, or at least a lot of it, and it taught me a lot of things about stories. I think I actually sold four or five of them a few years later, but we had a ritualistic burning of most of them when we moved to Nacogdoches, and by that time I was selling more stories and, you know, things were picking up, but I think, you know, having a writer's club can help, but I also think it can hinder, too, and you start to write for the pleasure of other people. I always try to write like everybody I know is dead. Because if I start trying to write for Uncle Bill and Aunt Willie and wonder if Mom's going to be offended, then I'm not going to write straight out. I'm not going to write what's in my mind to write or what's in my heart to write. So I do that. Then when I get through, I hope those same people have reappeared and want to buy the book or want to buy the story. But I can't do that when I'm writing because it makes you self-conscious. And that's a serious thing I learned along with that 90 days is write a lot, read all the time, and don't worry about what other people think because you can't figure it out because everybody's different. It's a foolish errand.
Joe, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Joe R. Lansdale's new book is Honky Tonk Samurai. The Sundance Channel series based on his characters Hap and Leonard premieres next Wednesday. In February 1966, New York's Village Vanguard booked the new Thad Jones Mel Lewis Big Band to play two Monday nights. That engagement got extended to a month and then some. The orchestra they founded is still playing Mondays at the Vanguard 50 years later. A new live set includes some music from their opening night. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says they got it right the first time.
Thad Jones spent years playing trumpet with Count Basie and writing tunes and arrangements for his band. Some of his charts were a little weird for Basie, and Jones filed them away with some other unheard music. Then he and drummer Mel Lewis started a rehearsal band with top musicians they knew, mostly from New York's TV studios. They rehearsed Jones's music 2 or 3 months and then went into the Vanguard. First Monday in February 1966. The place was packed, the crowd was friendly, and the band was drilled and ready. They had a quiver of good tunes, like Thad Jones's Mornin' Reverend. It's very 60s Ellington, with a signature beat and silky saxophones under wah-wah brass. Thank you. That's like Ellington with a little more church in it, edging toward Charles Mingus territory. The Mingus influence was oddly pronounced on opening night in the cross-talking horns and controlled chaos. Thad Jones would conduct the band out front, shaping details and phrasing with hand signals. Conducting improvisers is one of those eternally newfangled ideas band leaders have been using forever. Music from Thad Jones and Mel Lewis's first and seventh Mondays at the Village Vanguard is out on a two-CD set, All My Yesterdays, which includes a fat book of interviews with early and later band members. As one points out, even when the harmony gets weird, if it's swinging, people will dig it. Yeah, and it's always swinging. The band's original rhythm section had Thad's brother Hank Jones on piano, Richard Davis when that bass player could do no wrong, and spark plug Mel Lewis behind the drums, accenting the solos, backing up riffs, and shooing everybody along. Jerome Richardson on alto sax on Little Pixie. When the band gets recorded again 6 Mondays later, the ensemble blend is smoother and the solos more calm. I miss the crazy energy of opening night. On the plus side, by mid-March, band mainstay Pepper Adams had come in on baritone saxophone. His composition-minded solo on Once Around extends the written material that sets it up. And when pianist Hank Jones hears where he's going, he sneaks up behind Adams on Little Mouse Feet. After a dozen Mondays at the Vanguard, the orchestra went into the studio for the first time, and by then the music had been polished to a high gloss. The ensemble playing was beautiful. The band, now known as the Vanguard Jazz Orchestra, has had some raucous nights since the early days. But that very first gig was the big band's big bang, an explosion of the creative energy it still feeds on long after the founders passed on. This orchestra has been going strong for 50 years now. That's big. I can't quite get my head around it.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and Tone Audio and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed All My Yesterdays, the debut 1966 recordings at the Village Vanguard by the Thad Jones Mel Lewis Orchestra. Our next guest is British actress Maggie Smith. She stars in the new film The Lady in the Van, which is based on the true story of a homeless woman who lived in an immobile van parked for 15 years in the driveway of writer Alan Bennett. She's appeared in more than 50 films and is among only a handful of performers to win Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress at the Academy Awards. Those honors, for the prime of Miss Jean Brody in California Suite, date back to 1970 and 79. But Maggie Smith has become better known to American audiences in recent years for playing Professor McGonagall in the Harry Potter films and for her scene-stealing performances as the Dowager Countess in the masterpiece series Downton Abbey, which wraps up its final season March 6th. Well, Maggie Smith, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
We must talk about Downton Abbey, which has just been so enormously popular in the United States and Britain. How did this role of the Dowager Countess come to you?
Well, I would suspect from because I'd done Gosford Park, a film that Julian had written that Robert Altman directed.
Julian Fellowes, who created Downton.
Yes, Julian Fellowes. And I can't remember when that was. I'm hopeless. All I know is the time is going past so fast. It must have been some time ago.
2001. You know?
Yeah. Well, there you go. That is some time ago.
Longer than I would have thought also.
But I remember meeting up with him and him saying he'd written this part and he hoped that I would do it. And yes, I certainly did do it.
Well, let's listen to a clip. This is one fairly early in the series where you are speaking with Lady Grantham, who is played by Elizabeth McGovern. And just as background, there's brief mention of an incident which had happened at Downton Abbey, which was that a young Turkish diplomat had actually died in a bedroom there. That's mentioned in what we're about to hear. But in this scene, you as the Dowager Countess are speaking with Lady Grantham about finding a suitable husband for Lady Mary, the eldest Crawley daughter. Let's listen.
How about some house parties?
She's been asked to one next month by Lady Anne McNair.
That's a terrible idea. She doesn't know anyone under 100.
I might send her over to visit my aunt. She could get to know New York.
Oh, I don't think things are quite that desperate. Poor Mary. She's been terribly down in the mouth lately.
She was very upset by the death of poor Mr. Pamuk.
Why? She didn't know him. One can't go to pieces at the death of every foreigner. We'd all be in a state of collapse whenever we opened a newspaper.
And that is our guest, Maggie Smith, with Elizabeth McGovern from A Moment of Downton Abbey. I mean, you know, this is a wonderful, you know, ensemble cast, but everyone remembers you and those terrific lines you have. Did you realize what a great comedic role this was when you first got it?
Yes. Yes, I did. I thought it was great fun because she was obviously the oldest in the group. And it was wonderful because she would just sort of she was in the position when she could say what she wanted to say because she was the older and they all deferred to her, and that was it was fun. I'm so glad you said that about the ensemble, because we've got 3 awards for ensemble work, which is really good. 3 SAG awards, which is terrific for the whole company.
We interviewed Julian Fellowes a while back, and he said that he based your character on an aunt of his, I believe.
Yeah.
And he said what was terrific about Maggie Smith was that she was able to combine the contradictions in the role, someone who could at times be so cutting and then be so kind, and sort of integrated them. And he said that only an actress of your talent and stature could pull it off. Any particular inspiration for you finding this character?
No, well, it was mainly the way it was written by Julian, which was terrific, you know, and the wonderful lines to say, and it was written so elegantly. She was always very in sympathy with the girls, I think, the very young. Mm-hmm. She was very helpful to all of them, and I think she knew that they felt restricted.
Right, she understood the constraints of those roles better than anyone. Right.
Yes, completely, because she'd been through it even stricter, but I think she was very aware of it.
You know, Julian Fellowes writes about this life partly with some personal knowledge. I mean, he actually holds a title, which I don't remember, but...
Oh, he's frightfully grand. He's a lord.
Right. And so he had a connection...
We do a lot of curtsying.
He had a personal connection to that world. What was your sense of the English aristocracy?
Oh, goodness, it's so way beyond me. I'm far, far, far from that. But, of course, that's one of the joys of acting, is that you can move up in the world, even if you know, in the characters that you're playing, even if you don't. So it was... It's always very nice to be somebody rather grand. Now I seem to be stuck with it, which is a bit of a strain.
Stuck with
a
role.
I think with old mad women. If you know what I mean, they seem to be the one thing I can do now. you know, it's funny to be pigeonholed so late in life, but there we are.
You can go on YouTube and find montages of your lines in Downton, one after the other, after the other, after the other. Do you have a favorite one yourself?
I don't remember any of them, to speak truth.
The one that people...
honestly, there are so many. I don't remember.
The line people most mention to me is when Matthew Crawley is talking about how he would manage his time, and he said, there's always the weekend.
Oh,
and you say...
Yes. What is a weekend? Yes, but truthfully, I mean, it's funny, but it's weird that it sticks in people's memories so much, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is so funny about saying what is a weekend?
It's the fact that this woman has grown to her age and hasn't distinguished the weekend days from any other.
No, they've all been lazy, idle times. But even so, it seems odd, doesn't it?
It's the way she says it, I think.
Maybe it's the way you say it. The thing I remember a lot is the swivel chair.
Right.
I remember, I like that bit.
Your character sits in a swivel chair. And
yes, and she's very surprised and indignant that it moves. She hasn't come across those.
Yeah. Electric lights, has no use for electric lights, yeah.
No, that was a terrible shock to her when they had electric light in the house. It must have been to many people, actually, if you think about it, and they're all in that sort of the gloom of oil lamps and candles and things.
Sure. The other thing we must mention is your foil in so many of the episodes, Isabel Crawley, played by Penelope Wilton.
Oh, my lovely friend Penelope Wilton.
Yeah.
Isn't she terrific?
You're both terrific in it.
She's stunning.
You want to tell us anything about how you do those scenes, the two of you?
Well, we do with a great deal of laughter. We used to laugh a lot. It was quite funny. One day we were doing a scene and I had a stick all the time in the series, which is just as well because I needed to have a new hip by the end of it. But it was quite funny because I got up in this scene to say something to Penelope and I had my stick and I was sort of doing that awful teetering and crouching about. And I said to Penelope, why am I acting old? I've got there. It's the one thing I don't need to act. And we got quite hysterical. I thought, why indeed am I doing that awful acting when you've got a stick and you do sort of crouch over? And I said, I don't need to do this. Sort of what you do at drama school when asked to play something way out of your reach. Anyway, we used to laugh a lot about that. I used to say, I'm not going to act old Penelope. I'll just be myself.
That's great. Michael Coveney, who's written a biography of you, he wrote, you behave at all times as if you have no power or status whatsoever. And, you know, when I think about the remarkable talent that you seem to display in every performance, you know, there are stories that on the set you can be intimidating, maybe even difficult at times, which seems at odds with someone who, well, one might think is at odds with someone who really doesn't think of herself as having power and status. And I'm wondering if you think that's true, that you are.
Yeah. Yes, I think it is true. But I think it's because I've thought about this a lot. I think it's because I know it sounds silly, but I am, and I think a lot of actors will agree with this, I am very insecure. And I don't know, I feel somehow on a set, I feel a bit trapped because you're in a corner and you absolutely have to do it. There is no way out. In the theatre, you know, you get another chance. You can do it the next night, the next performance. You can probably get it right then. But you don't have any real say in a film. And quite honestly, I'd probably drive everybody mad and go on and on and on and want to do another take and because I never feel that it's right. So I always feel huge pressure. It's an odd feeling, but when you're there and you're having to do it, the choice you make has to be absolutely right. And of course it can't be. It just absolutely can't be. So you don't really have a say in it. I find it very hard because I don't know that I trust myself to know that if it's good or if that's the take that should be, or whether we just do it with one take, or there isn't time to do any more, you know. And I find that a real pressure.
And that can lead to some tension at times, yeah.
Yes. I think there's always great tension because there never seems to be enough. There is always pressure. There's always pressure because there isn't enough time. There's never enough time for a movie, it seems to me. Never.
You know, what's interesting about it is that I think so many people see your performances and you make it look easy. I mean, this is natural. There's no other way that line could have been read.
And
you're saying that you have to work really hard and prepare, and you still feel insecure on the day you shoot.
Yes, because that's the pressure. You want so much to get it right. And you know, there's a thing in your head that kind of says to you, yes, I think that was nearer it, you know. But when people are all around you and the pressure is that you've got to get this shot in, you know, or the light's going to go, you know. I have such admiration for film actors. I can't tell you. They were all, well, not all of them were there, but at the BAFTAs the other night. I was there and I just thought, my goodness.
The BAFTA Awards, yes.
Yes. And Leonardo DiCaprio was there and you just think, what he went through in that movie.
The Revenant, yeah. He gave you a big kiss, which got a lot of attention, by the way.
He did indeed. And that was the thrill for me. Real thrill. Because I think he's a terrific actor. And I've been rooting and voting for him since Gilbert Grape. I thought he was so amazing in that when he was a young man. Really very young boy, wasn't he?
Do you watch your films and your television performances?
No.
Why?
Because I can't do anything about them. That's part of the pressure.
Yeah. So you're never quite satisfied?
Well, no. And then you watch them and you think, why in the name of God did I do that? I'm sitting here cringing listening to back to those things. You think, oh, no, I'd do it all differently now.
Huh. We're all enjoying it, and you're cringing.
But I do everything differently. No, I wouldn't. You can't go back and do that.
When I told people I was going to interview Maggie Smith, I just can't tell you the number of people who said, "Oh my heavens, you're so lucky! I just love her." And I think, you know, you've particularly had an expanded audience with Downton Abbey and the Harry Potter films. But you know, you have such a terrific career, and you've achieved so much, and so many people just love you. And I'm wondering what that kind of mass adoration feels like to you. Is it gratifying? Is it scary? Can you even comprehend it?
Well, it's only happened to me since Downton Abbey, so I blame the whole thing on television. It's odd, and I've said this before, but I find it very difficult to do anything on my own now because people recognize me. This has never happened to me before because I haven't really done television before. But I suppose if you're in people's rooms all the time, I don't know. I was thinking that the other night with people like DiCaprio and, you know, those big stars and Cate Blanchett, and you just think, how do they exist? It's so difficult, and I think now it's very intrusive because of these cell phones, you know, with cameras.
Right.
Wherever you go, people want to take a picture of you or take a picture of them with you. And it's hard to do anything on your own.
How do you react when someone, you know, John Cleese told me, he just tells people, I don't do pictures, I'm sorry.
No, I do say that. It depends. Obviously, it depends who it is. If it's a very young person, you know, a child, of course you would. But it is incredibly intrusive.
And if it's not too intrusive, you live in a 15th century farmhouse, is that right?
It's at the moment, it looks as though it's never been at all because it's being, I'm having to really have a go at rewiring it and do things because it is indeed very old.
Electric lights, yeah.
Well, yes, I think you'd turn every light on with rubber shoes on, if you've got any sense.
Do you want to take one question about Harry Potter, or would you rather be released?
I would rather be released. I think you've been adorable.
Okay, well, no, I don't know about that.
What do you want to know about Harry Potter?
Just what was it like to play that role, to act in those films?
Well, I'll tell you, I just adore Daniel Radcliffe, who I had worked with before Harry Potter and spent a long time telling all the producers they had to see him because I thought he was so terrific. And it's been sad thinking about it because of Alan Rickman.
Oh, who died recently, yeah.
Yes, he was such a terrific actor, and that was such a terrific character that he played. And it was a joy to be with him. We used to laugh together because we ran out of reaction shots. They were always, when everything had been done and the children were finished, they would turn the camera around and we'd have to do various reaction shots of amazement or sadness and things. And we used to say we'd got to about number 200 and something, and we'd run out of knowing what to do when the camera came round on us. Huh. But he was a joy.
Maggie Smith, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Maggie Smith stars in the new film, The Lady in the Van. Her performances as the Dowager Countess come to an end March 6th with the final episode of the masterpiece series, Downton Abbey. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesbert is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.